Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:30, and today is Friday, June 5th. And of course, today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio for the various different asset classes. Well, this has been a volatile week, and not least in the bond markets. And I think that really is the most appropriate place to start because, well, for a long time that we've been identifying the Treasury market as being the biggest bubble of them all, that this is a 35-year bull market, and it's hard to imagine how it could possibly go any higher. When we just think first, and to put this whole discussion in terms, in context, think about any bull market. As a bull market progresses, confidence improves. This is compounded by the fact that prices are going up. There is absolutely nothing that creates confidence in investor sentiment like making money. And there is no doubt that people who have been long of bonds have made a great deal of money. As prices rise, people become more established in terms of their view, and the buy and hold strategy takes hold. Now, one of the reasons for that is because the expensive trading and the potential downside risk of getting out too early and getting in too late in the context of a big bull market means that often people are willing to sit through reactions and corrections because they believe that prices will go higher later. In other words, they're willing to take short-term gain for medium to long-term short-term pain for medium to long-term gain, and they are rewarded for doing so. That also means that it is more difficult to sell later because you've had this confirmation bias with it by being rewarded for following a strategy of accepting pain. That means that it's hard for people to sell. It's always harder to sell than it is to buy. We buy on optimism, but we sell on pessimism. And, well, human beings are generally optimistic. We prefer to think of the future as being optimistic and that we don't want to miss out, so we don't want to sell. It means that because of that bias, as any bull market progresses, supply increases. The number of people that are benefiting increases. Then they want more of the thing. The supply side responds and supply increases. Then what happens is that eventually supply will overwhelm demand, at which point prices begin to fall, and all of that pent up supply where people didn't want to sell becomes, sated demand becomes potential future supply, and you move into a bear market. Now let's start to tick boxes in terms of the bond bull market. Well, this has been persisted for a long time, and anyone who has bought the dips and maintained a buy and hold strategy has done very well. The confirmation bias is such that if you are now 60 years old and have been trading in this market for the last 35 years, then you've spent your entire career to date buying the dips, and you've been richly rewarded for doing so. Until that strategy starts to stop working, then we won't really have any kind of confirmation that the real bull market, even though it's 35 years long on the tooth, is over. What we've seen just in the last 10 days is not enough to really shake that kind of conviction. And that's why today, in today's comment of the day, I've posted these log scale charts of the 10-year and the 30-year, because it's the progression of lower rally highs is rivetingly consistent. And anyone who was buying bonds when yields got up to that progression of lower rally highs has been making money for a very long time. It's looking increasingly likely that bonds are going to get up to test that progression of lower rally highs, but that's when the rubber really hits the road. That's where we're really going to see whether yields are going to expand further at that point. And it would be cavalier to say that this is it, that we have seen that this is going to be the pullback in the bond market that is the big one. We simply don't know yet what is looking. Then you tend to look at this market from the short, the medium, and the long term. In the short term, yields look like they are going higher. In the medium term, then we're likely to see that long progression of lower rally highs in the yield tested. But over the long term, this looks like a type 3 developing bottom. Well, type 3 bottoms defined at the chart seminar are ranging time and size. Well, the range is a number of years. The size is really very large. And it looks like we've seen the bottom in yields. But what we don't know is how long this ranging phase will persist for. It could be another while longer. We just simply don't know until that progression of lower rally highs in the yield has been broken. And that's still a ways off. Well, one of the things that is, this is, I suppose, perhaps the most important call of them all. We just don't know. But it's looking increasingly likely that the Fed will be raising rates at some point. The contention that we've had is that they'll raise rates at some point this year, and today's job report is skewing the perception that it might be in September. Whether it is September, October, November, or December is actually not that important. What we do know is that the pace of the advance, once they begin to start raising rates, will be very mild. And it has to be. It necessarily has to be mild because every other central bank in the world is cutting interest rates. The dollar is already firm. And the Fed certainly doesn't want to see the dollar getting out of hand in terms of how strong it could possibly get, because the move has already been abrupt. They may be willing to tolerate a dollar that is appreciating at a mild pace. They do not want a dollar that's appreciating at a rapid pace. That means that the strength of the dollar has already impacted the ability of exporters to grow and has reduced the competitiveness of the US economy. In other words, it is already fulfilling some of the functions of raising interest rates. The extent to which the dollar rallies additionally is likely to be an arbiter in terms of what the Fed does. When you look at the inflation measure that they prefer, the PCE deflator, then you don't have evidence of inflationary bias there. When you look at jobs, then unemployment is coming back to trend. It's coming back towards the 5% level, which in many respects is total employment, and wage growth is starting to improve. Well, then it depends on how you're going to measure that wage growth. There was an article in yesterday's Wall Street Journal showing that the wage growth had already broken out, and average hourly earnings has been range-bound for nearly 5 years. It's at the upper side of the range just now. The last time it was updated was at the end of April. We haven't got the update for May just yet. But what it is looking like is that if I look around at the people that I know, that they've moved jobs because they got better money. That a number of cities, not least and most recently Los Angeles, have voted to have some of the highest minimum wages in the world. Well, that might appear to be the triumph of will over experience, but what it suggests is that people are demanding higher wages. Well, higher wages are something that move the needle for the Fed. But the question is, will it be counterbalanced by the strength of the US dollar? But more importantly, if growth is starting to pick up and the natural advantages of the US economy are starting to come to the fore and unemployment is improving, this is a benign environment. And the extent to which extraordinary monetary policy is appropriate in that environment is open to question. This is then the big question. The Fed has already lowered its, has removed its quantitative easing program. And it's one of the biggest holders of treasuries in a market which is at present relatively illiquid. the banks are no longer capable of providing the kind of market liquidity that they might once have, for the simple reason that they have been regulated out of the market. The holders of it within the investment community of bonds represent a potential source of supply, and so does the Fed. The Fed holds $3 trillion worth of treasuries. There's a similar quantity in the bond fund market. This is an awful lot of money, which is being withheld from the market. It would be, I would suspect, grossly negligent of the Fed to start removing some of the money supply that it has in the market. They're a long way from doing that. This is going to be an incredibly gradual process of normalizing monetary policy. But if we're heading into a benign environment, then yields are incredibly low. Then it tells us that the yield to maturity is no longer a consideration for the majority of bond investors. High yield bonds generally have really only taken off as an asset class within the last 30 years. They are a product of the secular bull market in bonds. And these things don't mature. High yield debt very rarely is matured at par. Then what often happens, most often happens, is that it is refinanced, that it is either it is upgraded to investment grade, or that it's called back by the issuer. Well, what that means is that not even the issuers themselves are worried about a yield to maturity. Well, that refinancing debt has been incredibly beneficial in this incredibly low market environment, low interest rate environment, and companies have been falling over themselves to issue additional debt, and they've been refinancing, they've improved their weighted average cost of capital, they've been buying back their own shares, and they've issued an incredible amount of debt. That isn't just the most high quality of borrowers, where that wouldn't be a problem, but that covenant light lending has surpassed by a considerable margin the highs that we saw in 2007. Well, these are the kind of people that you wouldn't, if you were the person lending your money, you wouldn't give them it. You wouldn't give it to them. And we've just issued more money to them than anyone ever thought possible, considering that it was the asset class that people said never again after the financial crisis. Well, covenant light lending is likely to become a problem. Now, the possibility that this is going to turn into a lengthy type 3 base formation, even lengthier than we've already had, is compounded by the fact that refinancing is not a problem at present. That even if interest rates were to rise from here, that it wouldn't still be a problem at such a low level, and considering that the Fed is probably going to be raising rates at a very moderate pace. But the wall of refinancing corporate debt starts to come through in 2017 and 2018, where you have in the region of $300 billion in those years that needs to be refinanced. And I don't think anybody thinks that yields are going to be at the current level in 3 years' time. Well, that is where the potential for a pretty considerable yield expansion is going to lie. And it could happen before that, because obviously markets tend to price these things in. So this is still we continue to view this as a major bubble in both in treasury bonds and in corporate debt, and that yields are at low absolute levels and spreads are at historically tight levels, so that you don't really have to think about too many scenarios that these things are going to change. The strength of the dollar is something that we haven't had to deal with in a long time, that the dollar trended lower for over a decade, and that's over now. the U.S. economy has got some internal strengths, and not least on a relative basis compared to the rest of the global economy, that are non-trivial, and that this is contributing to the strength of the dollar. This isn't something that's going to play out in the short term. This is looking increasingly like a long-term trend, and that the dollar index has broken out. We're in a process of consolidation for the dollar at the present moment, that you had a very powerful breakout earlier this year, and that we're still in a mean reversion ranging phase, or first step above the base in terms of the dollar index, but that you would have to have some serious dollar deterioration before you could conclude that this isn't the evolution of a new medium to long-term bull market for the US dollar. It means that we need to look way more at currencies going forward than we ever have before. Japan's devaluation of the yen in 2012 was a major catalyst for the Asian region. This was a regional heavyweight economy going all out to devalue its currency. It made the jobs of its neighbors who compete with Japan for manufacturing that much more difficult. Well, Asian countries were willing to allow their currencies to appreciate in an environment where everybody was allowing their currency to appreciate around the same time. Well, with Japan devaluing its currency, it set off a competitive devaluation right across the region. And this is particularly true for countries like Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore, Thailand, and also, and I guess more recently, South Korea. India's not really in that camp because it doesn't have the manufacturing center that those other countries do, but of course it does have a balance of payments problem, which has compounded the weakness of the rupee over the last few years and the relative strength of the rupee recently because of the fact that it has a new prime minister and central banker, both of whom are reform-minded and growth-oriented. Well, what it means is that we're going to have, well, I guess the other way to say it is that people became really very interested in the Asian region because they were able to get capital market, currency market, and yield appreciation when they were investing there from a foreign jurisdiction. Well, you might still have the potential for capital market appreciation, but that the question is whether that's going to be eaten up in terms of the devaluation of their respective currencies. The Asia dollar index has completed a type 3 top and is encountering resistance in the region of the moving average and testing its lows. That's not the kind of chart pattern where one could have a great deal of confidence that these currencies are going to get additionally firm. Well, in fact, with the yen breaking down and extending its medium-term downtrend this week, then the potential for Asian currencies to also take an additional leg down is becoming increasingly likely. And it means that what we need to do is to look not just at the nominal price indices for these country indexes, but also to look at the performance of their respective currencies. That the number of hedged instruments is likely to balloon over the next number of years for that simple reason. And with interest rates still towards the lower regions, then the cost of hedging at the present moment is not that expensive. Well, when we think about the euro, there isn't really any country wants a strong currency, and the eurozone needs a weak currency. I guess Greece has really been stealing the limelight in here over the last couple of weeks, not least because Mr. Tsipras in Greece is really playing hardball, and they don't want to leave the euro, but they're certainly acting like they're prepared to do so. That has obviously got a lot of people on edge in here. It's one of the reasons that, despite the fact that the dollar was firmer in here today and the euro was lower, that the majority of European indices were in negative territory. They're not really responding to the inverse correlation with the euro at the present moment because there are more pressing considerations in the short term. Greece took another leg down in here today. It's encountering resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average. The DAX moved to a new recovery low, sorry, a new reaction low, and is pulling additionally back towards the region of the 200-day moving average. The weakness of the euro is going to accrue for the region's export market. That's something that's likely to be a medium-term consideration, because it's going to take time for the devaluation of the currency to really filter through into the earnings. Well, it means that this is the predicate for a medium-term bull market in Europe, and they don't want to see Europe or Greece leave, and Greece doesn't want to leave, but that this is still a very liquid environment, and there is the potential that, I guess, personalities get in the way of common sense, and that you do have an accident in here in terms of a member of the euro deciding to go to the exit. And there is ample tools available to the ECB to provide liquidity. They really can do whatever they want when they have control of the printing press. And anyone who thinks that they can't just needs to look at the extent to which the Fed was able to increase the size of its balance sheet. Well, it means then that when we tend to look at the euro in this ranging phase, that there isn't really an argument for additional strength in the euro. The Europeans absolutely need a weak currency in here. Excuse me. Well, dollar strength and euro weakness and this move in the US dollar, they're very big moves. That when we look at the broader global economy that we've been rallying for much of the last 6 years, and it has been a liquidity-driven environment. The number of dollars in the world is approximately 15 trillion, and that's if you compound the size of the balance sheets of the Fed, the ECB, the Bank of Japan, the People's Bank of China, and the Bank of England, and you redenominate the whole lot into US dollars. Well, the Fed isn't going to be printing any additional dollars. They're not going to remove any of the bonds that they have. They simply can't do that, or the dollar would really go up a lot. So what we've seen is that capital is both mobile and global, but that generally speaking, the liquidity tends to stay in the place that it is produced. So Europe is involved in quantitative easing, and that should be generally beneficial for its stock markets. Japan is involved in quantitative easing, and that's beneficial for its stock market, at least in nominal terms. The S&P 500 has been range-bound since December, and the quantitative easing program ended in October. It's in need of a bullish catalyst, and since the market has been dependent on liquidity provision, then that is likely to be contingent on the Fed providing additional liquidity. And the only possible scenario for that is either that growth starts to underperform, or inflation doesn't pick up, or that they want to keep the dollar lower. Well, we're not there just yet. There's no indication that the Fed is prepared to do that. But it means that Wall Street, having been among the best performing stock markets over the last 6 years, could underperform for the rest of the year. And we could move into a lengthier period of consolidation. Well, when you go back and then take some big long-term perspective and look at really about as much history as you can possibly find, then the S&P 500 broke out of a 13-year range a year and a half ago. It's rallied really pretty spectacularly, and that it wouldn't be at all surprising that we see a first step above this long base. That would be potentially a year or even a two-year range before valuations improve once more, earnings start to catch up with the performance, and then we move into a secular bull market. Well, what would a secular bull market look like? You can't have a secular bull market without productivity growth. And that's then where the natural advantages of the US economy really start to come through. That we're in a period of time where the pace of technological innovation is accelerating. It's accelerating not just because of short-term events, but that it takes a long term for the genesis of new technologies to really come through. And this has been a trend that has been building for a long time. Well, we're now starting to see the commercialization of a lot of products, and not least in the healthcare sector. Well, if you think of one sector that is grossly inefficient and in need of rationalization and technological innovation, it's healthcare. Well, we can see that perhaps more important is that not just that we're getting new technologies, but that the development of one technology is enhancing the productivity of other technologies, which are then furthering the innovation spiral. And this is something that's unlikely to slow down, that the process of Moore's Law, where the cost and efficiency of computer chips doubles every 18 months, is increasingly being applied to additional sectors, so that it's being applied to solar technology, and it's being applied to robotics, and it's being applied to the nanotechnology sector and in healthcare, and that these are all benefiting each other, so that the pace of technological innovation is improving, the amount of work that can be achieved per unit of labor is improving steadily. That's going to contribute to productivity growth for an individual economy. But the fact that not only is this happening here, but that these technologies are going global almost instantly, means that the number of steps that a worker somewhere else can skip in terms of their personal development and reaching their productivity goals or their potential for productivity is rapidly increasing as well. If we think about the major secular bull markets that we've had before, that there was Japan, which was really just one country, that there was the TNT bubble, which was really just Europe in the USA, whereas what we're moving into is a period of time where the global economy is likely to experience productivity growth. And that's very, very big news indeed. Well, it's not just big news because of the technological innovation and the availability of technology, but also that we have more people and that governance is improving. That unrest has increased in places where governance is not improving. We can't say that governance is improving everywhere. This is not an era of world peace. In fact, the potential for conflagration in various parts of the world is probably going to increase as energy prices range, and certainly range below where a lot of people thought that they would have been at substantially higher prices for a long time. I think that there is a very high correlation between increased geopolitical stress in energy-producing parts of the world as a result of lower energy prices than there might have been previously. We have excellent examples in these countries of where governance has broken down, where the administrations did not grasp the nettle of really moving to improve the path to prosperity for their populations. What we are seeing is that countries who have decided that they're going to try and improve the living standards of all of their populations and create a path to prosperity for their people, that they're benefiting enormously. But perhaps more important is that the places that are really benefiting enormously are major population centers, so that not only do we have technological innovation and availability, but that we have lots more people who can benefit from it. Well, the oldest adage from the commodity markets is that the cure for high prices is high prices. That if you think about the context of the sort of psychological perception stages that we discussed at the beginning of the audio and apply them to the energy sector, that we've had massive investment in supply, and that supply is now reaching the market. We do not have the demand growth profile that a lot of people had been pricing in when that investment was made. And prices are currently rallying from very low levels. Oil today was up 90 cents and reversed a decline of about a dollar. So we're still in this short-term range, and this is still a process of mean reversion. The Baker Hughes rig count has not yet turned lower, and has not turned higher, and that's an indication that drilling has not picked up. We won't really have an indication of the supply from the marginal source of supply, which is unconventional oil and gas, starting to turn higher until that rig count starts to turn up. And that is, I think, what a lot of people are looking at. When we think about the medium term, the prospect of oil ranging in a volatile manner between the 40-ish dollar area and the 80-ish dollar area is really quite high. That around $80, a great deal of unconventional oil and gas becomes economic. And in that regard, it could be really quite similar to the natural gas price, where a great deal of additional supply becomes economic at $4. Well, if we have energy prices that are not at persistently high levels, and that we move into a ranging environment rather than a trending environment, then the potential for energy to have been a headwind for economic growth deteriorates. But the potential for energy prices to range is perhaps a secular phenomenon when we consider that the potential for solar and renewable energy to really change the outlook from the perspective of distributed supply and integrating with home batteries, it's really quite an amazing possibility. The fact that just a few months ago, that for the first time ever, that chemists have been able to replicate photosynthesis without the need for electricity is really quite groundbreaking. That we're probably years away from when that might be commercially viable, but to think that we've been surrounded by trees converting sunlight into energy for millennia, and that we've only just figured out how to do it in the lab, is really quite an amazing development, and that's not something that is in the market at the present time at all. Well, it means that the chemical sector might be pulling back at the present time, but that the chemical sector is likely to do incredibly well out of this once it reaches commercial utility, and again, that won't be for quite some time. Well, it means that the potential for us to live in an energy abundant environment is only getting better, and that technological innovation is improving. But we have to get over the hump of the amount of debt that has been built up and come up with a realistic possibility that that debt load is going to deteriorate over time. And obviously the best way to do that is through growth. Growth has been absent for quite some time, but that needn't necessarily always be the case. And the fact that that is such an unpopular view is probably a good indication that it will probably be the thing that actually occurs. Well, I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.